Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we're talking about the road to cannabis industry equality, and we are joined by president of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, Jason Ortiz. Jason, thank you for being with us here this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure, and before we get into this topic, could you give us a little bit of background on the association and how you got involved with it?
Sure. So the Minority Cannabis Business Association is a 501c6 trade association comprised of cannabis entrepreneurs of color and other folks that are interested in supporting our mission, which is to bring more people of color into the cannabis industry as owners, employees, and as consumers. And so we try to bring as much of our community to the industry as possible and vice versa. Primarily, we do that through advocating for various public policies, but we also do education and entrepreneur support as much as we can. And I got my start in the cannabis industry actually, you know, way back when I was 16, and I got arrested for possession in high school. And that experience really showed me how the criminal justice system doesn't work necessarily for my community, and that really there was this thing called the war on drugs that was happening all around me and imprisoning thousands, if not millions, of people for cannabis possession. And so that experience really made me into an activist, and that work carried me forward into today, where we're now making sure that as we legalize cannabis, we're doing it as equitably as possible.
Jason, if you'd care to share, before we get into some of the meat and bones of our discussion, What does the criminal justice system present to a 16-year-old? Can you just give us a glimpse of how daunting and perhaps lopsided that process is?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was a double system for me because there's both the administrative system with my school, my high school, and then also the criminal justice system as an adult. And so I was 16 years old. I actually had just turned 16 a couple months prior to this. And it made a big difference because there were two other young people, my friends, that were with me. And the two 16-year-olds were tried as adults, and the 15-year-old was tried or didn't even have to go get tried as anything, but he was treated as a minor and had a much less severe penalty, and even though we were in the same grade together. But for me, you know, I didn't really realize how serious it was at first when it happened, and it wasn't until I got to review policies and see how other things were treated to realize that this particular thing I was getting in trouble for was treated so harshly. And so I remember sitting there with this big administrative body and my mom looking at the various punishments, you know, fighting was 3 days, stealing was 1 day, drinking alcohol in school was like 2 days, cannabis was 45 days, and then permanent expulsion for a second offense. So it was just dramatic. You could see it right there. And my mom asked the administrators, so what? This seems like a very punitive punishment, right? I didn't know what that word meant at the time. And they said, yes, it is. We are trying to make an example out of your son and all the folks that want to use cannabis, and that is not tolerated in school. And so that's when I learned that there are some laws that are meant to be overly harsh just to scare folks, and that's, you know, being a punitive punishment is all about. And I was a victim of that. And then actually seeing the real criminal justice system, the court, the Norwich, Connecticut Superior Court system, and see the types of folks that were prosecuting and the judges and the lawyers were all relatively older white men, and everybody else that was getting convictions were younger and darker, and also men generally speaking, but there was quite a few women of color as well. And so it just became clear that both of those systems had no interest in really helping me figuring this out. It was all just very, we're going to punish you and hope that other folks didn't do the same thing. And so that from day one I saw was both ineffective, but also just cruel.
Wow, that's just a shocking difference in punishment, and something that I definitely remember seeing as well, even here in Denver, Colorado, in the early 2000s. And you know, as we're having this conversation, of course, there has been such a focus on racial justice, social equity over the past month, 2 months. And of course, those mm-hmm. issues have always been there. They've, you know, it's just that when they start to come into the headlines and the focus starts to get put back on them, everybody starts talking about it. You see all of the activity and support on social media, and then it waxes and wanes, it seems, in mm-hmm. my opinion. But I'm just interested at a high level, how do you think the cannabis industry is doing overall as far as really being equitable? What's your perspective?
Pretty poor, or a low grade, however you would like to phrase it. I think, you know, just on the numbers, you see that there's very few people of color in ownership positions throughout the industry. That is getting better as more programs come online and more states come online. But especially when it comes to the existing medical infrastructure, that was incredibly racist in its impact, right? And so there was just so few people that were in ownership positions across the country that when most states kind of flip over using their existing infrastructure, that default means there's not going to be very many owners of color in the new infrastructure. And so far, yes, yeah, they're pretty bad. We're working to get more folks in ownership positions. And there are, you know, when I first started in 2015 or so, I know there was only a handful, and now there's definitely significantly more than that now. But if we look at percentage-wise, or how many folks are applying or actually getting licenses, and are the equity programs where a significant number of people of color are those programs coming online fast enough? Absolutely not.
Well, and let's talk about the issue of expungement really quickly, because this is a kind of another facet of this. And we recently saw Colorado Governor Jared Polis, years after legalization occurred here in Colorado, try to do something to remedy this. Give us a deeper dive, if you would, on kind of the considerations with expungement.
So the main issue with expungement is sort of how deep are we going to go as far as which charges we will expunge, and also how far back in time are we going to go. The biggest concern that I have is that we are legalizing massive amounts of sales and cultivation, right? Generally speaking, when we talk about legalization, that's what we're really talking about. But when it comes to expungement, it's only simple possession. And so the fight or the discussion around what can or cannot be expunged is getting a little more complicated, I think, than most folks thought. Take New Jersey, for example. They were trying to push an expungement through the legislature there, but because it was up to 50 pounds, I believe it was, it freaked a lot of folks out because a lot of people thought that was a tremendous amount of cannabis. And so it actually failed because the number was too high. And so we are seeing that in the nitty-gritty details, while some folks say they will expunge some records, it's actually pretty minimal what we're expunging. In Colorado, it is a bit more expansive. Luckily, Jared Polis is a fantastic advocate on this issue, so he wants to expunge a lot. But Colorado is a bit of an outlier at this point for having such an expansive process. California also did it pretty amazingly in Illinois, but those are more recent examples. Most of the states that came on early did not have a very strong expungement program.
Well, let's talk about the MCBA for a second. There's a number of organizations in the cannabis industry that mm-hmm. are designed to support minority involvement advancement in our industry. What is it in your mind that sets the MCBA apart, or that really gives it a specific mission that's caused it to be so successful thus far?
Sure. I think there's a number of things there at the beginning. It was more that we were combining the advocate community and the business community into one organization. I think a lot of the other orgs are one or the other, where we were trying to make sure both were talking to each other. And that, of course, brings challenges and opportunities to figure out what exactly it is that we want to do. But I think that we answered with what I do think what separates MCBA apart from most groups was our model legislation. And so MCBA brought together at first 25 to 30 individuals come together and build and see what is exactly that we wanted in terms of specific policies and draft our own piece of legislation.
So
that profit. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Sorry, Jason.
That process
we can.
Bringing,
by the way, we can. It's okay. We keep talking over each other. It's okay. You can keep recording, Halston. We'll just clean this one up after the fact. Jason, pretend I didn't say anything, and pick up where you thought on the count of three, if you would, please. One, two, go.
The process of bringing stakeholders to the table before we start the drafting was definitely something that was important to me as a community organizer, but it just made a better product. And so by bringing all these different people together that were either involved in organizations or entrepreneurs for a weekend to really decide, like, what do we want as a group? And I think that process of building consensus really empowered MCBA to then put out a product that everybody could support and push it everywhere. Because part of the challenge for MCBA is we can't actually help everyone that wants to get in the industry, or even everyone that wants to advocate. So we took the approach of, instead of trying to organize everyone, why don't we arm all the different people that are organizing with better policy? And so from there, we were able to help pretty much anyone. If you're advocating at the state level, start with MCBA's model bill as your point of discussion, and you'll start from a much more equitable spot. From there, we also created a model municipal ordinance for the local level. So anyone who wanted to lobby or advocate at the local level could use that particular piece of policy to advocate for equity at their municipal government.
Well, so that's a fantastic way to look at sort of this top-down approach to standardize things across the board. Let's talk for a moment about the sort of the bottom-up approach, and we're very proud at the Hoban Law Group that we helped and sponsored the MCBA's first conference in the University of Denver in 2017. And one of the things that resonates with me is the commentary that folks, minority-owned businesses, they felt as if they were not given a fair and equal opportunity when they were discussing things with investors, when they were presenting to investors, when they were given an opportunity to pitch something. And so, you know, one of the things that we'd like to do for the MCBA, we at the Hoban Law Group, is work together on some sort of program where we can help with investor preparedness on a pro bono basis. And that is something that we'll talk about outside of this call. But talk about that for a moment. Both sides of that coin, both the minority business owners' preparedness as a general rule, and the ability or the interaction with investors who, more often than not in this space in particular, are not led by minorities, and there's no minorities present.
For sure. So as far as the preparedness goes, you know, the fun part of MCBA is I get to see the wide range of cannabis entrepreneurs that are currently at the table. I mean, there are plenty of entrepreneurs of color that are already in business. And already doing, you know, fantastic work across the country, and, you know, maybe are now looking to compete on market share or much bigger projects, right? And so there are plenty of folks that are prepared, but it's those folks that are just coming online. They have a good idea. Maybe they know how to grow, or they have some skills, and they're really just trying to get their foot in the door, that we see the most trouble. And so part of the tension is that there's just not a lot of capital to go around regardless of your background. And so everyone is competing over a relatively small pool of private investment firms because we don't have access to traditional banking, right? And so in that space, the folks that are already doing well are going to be able to get what they need to do, but the folks that are coming on board aren't sure what they're worth, or they're not sure how much equity to give away in a lot of these different things, and they can't afford even the initial phase of having a lawyer come in to treat to help them out when it actually comes to reviewing contracts. And so when lots of money for some folks is dangled in front of them, you know, it might be the only time that they get a chance at getting some amount of interest or ownership, and they might take it without really reading through all the details. And we're seeing predatory lending of that type happening all over the place, and it's unfortunate and widespread. So MCBA is looking to start to have the states actually provide some oversight over what are acceptable contracts for equity applicants, because the states and the municipal governments as well are going to be investing in these folks a tremendous amount of resources. We should also be reviewing any investment contract that comes through with a state-approved attorney in order to provide them with that support and that kind of technical assistance. That currently doesn't exist, of course, and we're seeing what happens with that in places like LA, where the contracts and the licensing process is so mangled that it's getting really hard to keep up with what folks are or are not allowed to do to each other. And I think, you know, part of that is there's very few across-the-board standards on anything. But when you have both a capital crunch and a very short timeline for folks to get in applications, you're creating a predatory situation there. And so, you know, there's lots of ways I think we can go about addressing that, making licensing completely different, where it's not quite so time competitive, and that there are separate tracks for different types of entrepreneurs, I think is the best way to move forward. But in the short term, you know, MCBA is trying to make sure that folks at least have access to legal resources like yourselves or other attorneys that want to help folks before they sign on that dotted line, to make sure that all the sections of that contract jive with all the rest of them, and making sure that we do have some level, you know, a floor that we're going to say a bare minimum, all folks that are entering the cannabis industry, you know, deserve X, Y, and Z, and to make sure that that happens.
And you've identified, you know, some really important things for folks to think about, anybody really, but it's particularly highlighted when you look at the social equity scenarios, the contracts mm-hmm. by perhaps predatory investors or business operators and folks that just on their own don't understand the 35 pages of a particular contract, which is, you know, frankly, most of us. But when you go into that type of scenario, it puts people at a disadvantage. We've seen people, and Eric, we've talked about this, we've seen people being taken advantage of in licensing scenarios for their expertise, for their acumen, for their pedigree, whatever the case might be. And the social equity piece, unfortunately, while it's a laudable program, and it's certainly something that's necessary in this industry, absolutely, it's fertile ground for taking advantage of people, mm-hmm. saying, I want to go sure. apply for a license because I'll get preference if I have minority owners on a piece of paper, and going out and trying to find folks that fit that profile and then offering them a very one-sided deal. So I think that's extraordinarily important, Jason, and I'm glad you've focused in on that, because that is the downside, perhaps, to the social mm-hmm. equity process.
For sure. Well, and I think it's the social equity process that's also crammed in under this other really, you know, not effective licensing process, where it is highly competitive and you need to be highly capitalized and the window to apply is tiny. And so because you have such a short time frame to be able to figure things out, you have to figure out who can give you a large amount of money, or at least create the illusion of having a lot of money quickly. And so I think that's part of, you know, if we were to undo the traditional licensing that's highly limited and highly capitalized, the equity programs would operate differently, right? And so it's partly that the equity programs have to be changed, but also that the traditional, the basic licensing structure can inherently make the equity programs sort of moot, or so restrictive in the traditional licensing that the equity licenses become a hot topic for traditional businesses, right? And so if we're seeing MSOs see the equity space as their only ability to get into the market at all, they're going to invest a tremendous amount of resources to figure that system out too. And that is not what we're trying to see happen here.
Jason, while we have you, I want to shift away from the cannabis industry specifically and just talk in more general terms. I think it's probably fair to say that we live in a pretty polarized culture. And a good example of
yeah,
that is, you know, you have a lot of people who are saying Black Lives Matter, and then you have this very mm-hmm. reactionary All Lives Matter perspective. And so when we saw in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, we saw people saying defund the police. People wanted mm-hmm. to see action taken to really create systemic change. And I want to just dig into that, because the same people likely who are out there saying all lives matter were saying defund the police is a dangerous thing to be broadcasting. And so let's just give us some clarity on what defund the police actually means.
Well, it's going to mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And I'll say, I take a pretty progressive approach to defund the police. As far as MCBA, believe it's a matter, it's the same thing we've been talking about throughout the equity conversation for the last few years, of shifting away from a criminalization approach to handling drugs in general and investing in human resources and human needs and economic empowerment. And so in the broadest sense, it means we believe that the police have far more money and far more responsibilities than makes sense for the police. We have given so many responsibilities as far as handling mental health issues, addressing domestic violence concerns, all to somebody with a gun. And we simply don't believe that that is the best approach to solving a lot of these problems. It puts officers in a really odd spot of trying to address all of the various issues related to poverty, while at the same time only giving them the tool of violence to solve them. And so we just think that that is not the best approach to be doing this. It has resulted in mass incarceration. It has resulted in massive amounts of arrests for stroke, specifically for cannabis. And if we were to shift those resources away to other social services, like our schools, like healthcare, like various other, you know, mental health and social services, we would see better outcomes for everybody involved. And so I do believe, though, that the institution of the police has become more and more not only unnecessary, but it has become a predator upon our different communities. So I would like to see that budget reduced dramatically and replacing lots of things. But sadly, society is kind of going in the other direction up to this point. Like, let's just take our schools, for instance. We've cut the positions of teachers and guidance counselors and after-school programs and coaches, and replace it with putting police in schools to make sure that they can control any kind of situations. And so that is a direct example of just remove that police officer from the school and replace them with a guidance counselor would be defunding the police. And then as we start to think on the bigger scale and specific with the cannabis industry, like we saw in Portland, Oregon, we're seeing funds that were dedicated supposedly to our communities being used to further fund the police, which are used to oppress our communities. And so like in Portland, you know, Dr. Rachel Knox had a fantastic campaign to divert those funds where they were originally intended, which de facto is defunding the police, but quite honestly, the police never should have that money to begin with.
Yeah, we've seen that as an example, and Dr. Knox and her family are certainly very, very active in this industry on so many different fronts, and just absolutely fantastic people. But let's, you know, to your point, let's look at just as a couple different examples of things mm-hmm. that are happening around the country. In Los Angeles, at least it was announced by the mayor that they were going to divert millions of dollars away from the police LAPD budget and invest them in the communities. Not exactly sure what quote unquote investing it in the communities means, right? And that requires but you know, we can certainly dive into that one. But then of course Minnesota, where you know unfortunately all those terrible events surrounding George Floyd had occurred. That looks to be a scenario where they're literally saying, look, we're going to take the money away from this Minnesota police department and create something new. And I'm going to give mm-hmm. an example of where that actually worked. And it comes from my home state of New Jersey. So I grew up in southern New Jersey, and the city of Camden, New Jersey, right across the river from Philadelphia, is a city that has seen better days. And it was certainly in the 80s and into the early 90s, crime-ridden, drug-infested, the infrastructure of the city. The police were notoriously corrupt, notoriously from outside of the community. And, you know, there's certainly dozens and dozens of instances that I can think of that resembled just, you know, racist behavior in a city that's primarily black. Now, what happened was the city police department was so corrupt that the state went in and said, we can't allow this police department to exist anymore because, quite literally. So what they did was counties are typically arms of the state. Right. So the county, Camden County, as it's known, Camden County went in and said, we're going to create a brand new police force. So they literally defunded the Camden City Police Force. It doesn't exist anymore. And it happened very, very quickly. They offered, you know, retirement to hundreds of officers, or at least dozens upon dozens of officers. And they offered, you know, positions in the new police department from others, and came in with a brand new approach of community involvement, patrolling the beat, so to speak, getting connected to the community. And it actually seems to have worked. The open air drug markets in Camden, New Jersey, are, you know, at least not as prominent as they once were. Certain sections of the city appear to be coming back, and there appears at least to be some sort of positive and productive relationship between the folks. So it seems like it's a good example of maybe defunding the police and recreating it, but recreating it might just create other problems. Isn't that right, Jason?
Sure, but I think anytime we modernize an institution, like it will change, but it will be more adapted to the current needs. And so there's never a perfect, like, well, this is just going to be, you know, roses and sunshine afterwards, right? We are talking about, you know, enforcing the law. But I think if we can reimagine roles and reimagine with various stakeholders at the table, like what a better way of doing it is, it will be better for everybody involved, including the police. And I think there's also, when we do that, there's the idea we need to shift funds from the police over to other services to handle important things. But there's also some things that I don't think the police should be doing at all, or nobody should do, and that is arresting people for cannabis, right? So there are some services or, you know, things that the police do for society that I think could just stop, and we could just stop spending money on that as we reimagine all these other ways that the institution of police or of law enforcement or however we imagine it comes in. Because, you know, the reality is society is changing rapidly in lots of different ways, and we should have been reimagining the police, you know, every 20 years or so, and so now we're just long overdue. But I think your example that you gave is an excellent point of how it can be done, right? Like, there's a clear need, there's a clear interest here, bringing in new people with new ideas, but not so much of the baggage of the past or whatever corrupt networks that were in there is just going to produce a better entity, a bit more able to actually accomplish the goals of it. You know, institutions over time always concentrate power and become less adaptable to the current climate. And so I'm all for creating new institutions and trying things a new way.
Well, unfortunately, I do think that the police departments have reexamined themselves periodically and have reinvented themselves. And unbeknownst to me, and I think most of us as Americans, is they became a highly militarized, highly funded organization that resembles something from Call of Duty, or which is a surprise for all of us. So certainly that has to change. But I will say, in the city of Denver, I read an article today, in fact, that, to your point about there are things that police should not be responding to, that there has been a documented shift in the way that 911 calls, for example, into the city of Denver have staffed police responses by utilizing social workers in certain aspects. And then, to your point, everything really does come down to cannabis. And I don't say that lightly or flippantly, but when you talk about police brutality or police overreach issues, when you talk about the racial tensions of our time and beyond, a lot of this does come back to the fact that if we just treated the cannabis plant properly, you're a living, breathing example of this, and folks would not be derailed for something that's a simple plant that police should not be involved in, and people shouldn't have a criminal record that deprives them of opportunities for. So all of those things need to change. But in a short period of time, we've seen some movement. So I do see a positive light at the end of the tunnel, but that doesn't mean it's time to let up off the gas.
No, and you know, for sure. If you look at even just 2015, that's when Colorado legalized, 2014, sorry. And, you know, equity programs weren't really a big part of the conversation then. And now if you look at the cannabis industry and how we talk about things, like in Illinois, for instance, it's a mandatory part of moving forward. So we are making progress. It is a slow march towards justice, of course. Like, I was in Ferguson, Missouri under President Barack Obama when that was happening. And so this is the police overreach issue is one that is coming up, you know, time and time again. That being said, I think that our ability to solve the way that we are as a society really talking about fundamental changes to how we do things is, you know, a cause for optimism for sure.
As that march continues, I hope that you will join us again on the Hoban Minute. Jason, thank you so much for speaking with us today. You have a great day, my friend.
Right on. I will. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.